The following program originally aired in August 2010.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we are taking a look at a book. The book is Outcasts United, An American Town, A Refugee Team, and One Woman's Quest to Make a Difference. The author is Warren St. John, New York Times reporter. It takes a look at changes in a small southern town, in this case Clarkston, Georgia, brought about by an influx of refugees from all over the world. And specifically, a look at the difference made in the lives of many young people in that town by an American-educated Jordanian woman, Luma Mufle, who started three soccer teams called the Fugees, composed of refugee boys. It's the story of a determined woman who became involved in the lives of young charges. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be there.
Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the few.
I wanted to get to as close as I could. We appreciate you taking the hour to be with us. And I should say that there are some exciting things going on with not only the teams, but now a foundation, Fugees Family. So you can find information on that at fugeesfamily.org. And later in the hour, we'll get to a lot of the great programs going on now as a result of the work of Luma Mufle. I want to start with a little bit of your background, if I could. You grew up in Jordan, in Amman. Is that correct?
I did. I was born and raised in Amman, Jordan, and came to the United States when I was 18 to go to college.
And in Jordan, had an interest in sports and, in fact, encountered a coach there, I understand it, who had an influence on you, Coach Rhonda Brown, there at something called the American Community School.
Yeah, my parents made me attend British and American schools, and both those schools had a pretty good athletic program. And all my coaches growing up were Western coaches, but the one I think that impacted me the most was Coach Brown.
And it sounds like you followed in her footsteps. She was a loving but tough coach.
Yeah, I think all the coaches that had a really strong impact on me were the ones that used tough love. I mean, I played some Little League baseball also growing up, and my coaches were former Marines that worked at the U.S. Embassy, and they also had the tough love approach, and that was the method that got me to reach my fullest potential, and a lot of my other teammates as well. So I do agree with that approach a lot.
And that I guess you find it gets the most out of the athletes.
I think it does, because they have these high expectations of you and they push you to the limit and they don't make excuses for you. And the coaches that always made excuses for me, I would just get by with coasting. Mm-hmm. You know, be like, well, they don't expect this. I can show up late. I don't have to do this. But when a coach holds you accountable, then you want to excel.
So you played various sports, as I understand it, including soccer. Mm-hmm. What is it about soccer that remained a love of yours, right?
I think because it was the first sport I knew. You know, I grew up playing it in the streets with my cousins and brothers and neighbors. And so I grew up playing it very informally, not with a youth league or anything like that. And I remember, you know, waiting anxiously every 4 years for the World Cup and, you know, pretending I was a different soccer player each day, mm-hmm. You know, either scoring goals or saving goals or whatever it was. I think there's something very powerful to that game. And that's the one I've always loved the most.
And that truly is the worldwide sport, right? As most nations call it, football.
Yeah, it is.
Did you have
the most popular sport in the world?
Yeah, certainly. And that's the sport where you'll see kids in the streets, I guess, in most nations playing soccer.
Yeah, like I was speaking to a group of kids that were going to head out to the Peace Corps, and you know, they're asking for some pieces of advice, and I was like, you know what, just grab a soccer ball and walk out, and you'll instantly have a group of friends. You'll instantly have an in with the community because you will be one of them with that ball. Mm. You know, you won't be an outsider anymore.
You waited for the World Cup every 4 years. Did you have favorite players?
I had favorite teams. Brazil and Italy were my top teams. And mm-hmm. I remember watching like Zico and Socrates with the Brazilian team in 82 and 86. And yeah, mm-hmm. Brazilians have always been my favorite.
And so growing up and going to American and British schools, you learned English very well, obviously. And when you went to college, I was reading that roommates and friends didn't even know you were Jordanian for a while.
No, they didn't. You know, I don't try to call a lot of attention to myself. And so I tried to blend in as much as I could. And, yeah, even my best friend, who's my best friend now, the first 3 or 4 weeks of school, she didn't know, you know, where I was from. Like I said, I was from Jordan. She actually thought it was Jordan, Utah. Isn't there a
town? Oh, really?
Yeah. And I was like, no, it's not Jordan, Utah. And then she's like, she's like, so you're a diplomat's kid? I was like, no, I'm Arab. And she was just shocked because I wasn't what her stereotype of an Arab would be.
Then you decided to come to the United States for college in, I guess, upstate New York. And then you just found a college, Smith College in Massachusetts, that you liked.
Yeah.
Good experiences there in college?
It was incredible. I mean, it was good to be, it was my first time away from home. I think I did a lot of growing up, and I was on my own. You know, I had to do everything by myself and make decisions, you know, about when to study, when to go out, what to get involved in, and no one was telling me what to do. So, you know, it was a good learning process, and I loved it. I made some incredible friends at school, and, you know, got to experience things I never would have otherwise. Mm-hmm.
Then a very important experience. You made the decision, I don't know whether this was in your senior year, that you were going to stay in the United States. This is something your father did not want, to understand it.
I don't think most parents would have wanted that. You know, they thought most families that send their kids abroad expect them to come back, you know, to their country and work there and, you know, get married and start a family. And you know, I kind of wanted to try things out on my own. I liked the independence that the United States offered. I liked being able to just be anyone, you know, like in Jordan, like everyone knew my family, everyone knew, you know, who I was. And I kind of liked the anonymity that the United States offered. And I don't know, maybe I was being naive thinking, oh, I can make this on my own. I don't need anyone's support with it. But no, my family was not happy with that.
And in fact, you then had to make it on your own, right?
Yeah, it was like a rude awakening. I went from, you know, having everything to having nothing in a matter of a week. My dad wasn't happy with the decision. He said, you know, if you want to do this, you're going to do it on your own. And he cut me off financially and, I guess, physically or socially from the family. Mm. So I did. It was a tough couple of years.
Yeah, that must have been devastating emotionally to not have even emotional contact, you know, speaking contact with your family.
Yeah, I mean, I would call home and my dad would hang up. Like, he didn't let anyone in the family communicate with me. And it was hard because I'm very close to them. You know, I grew up in a family of 4 kids and, like, over 50 cousins. And, you know, we all knew, you know, we did stuff together all the time and family events together. And so that was really hard. And then being here and not having a family or anyone I can go to. So it's probably the most painful 2 years of my life. Mm.
And part of that, a very interesting experience, you, as a part of that, you were invited by a college friend to go work at a mountain resort in North Carolina?
Yeah, in Highlands, North Carolina.
And I don't know whether it was you or the people around you decided, you know, someone with a Muslim name that might not fit in. So you were called Liz.
Yeah. You know, it's a small town. It's predominantly white. Most of the people that worked at the restaurant were locals. And I don't think I'd ever met someone from out of the country. Some of them haven't, you know, don't even interact with people out of the state. So the owner, my friend, felt, you know, like it would be better if they knew me as Liz, as, you know, an American from Boston or wherever. So it was funny because they'd refer to me as Yankee and, you know, like it wasn't in a positive way. So I was like, well, they don't like anyone. Like, I don't think it would be a problem if they knew I was Arab. So,
As I understand it, apparently this kind of illustrates maybe the, you know, some of those tensions. There's a gentleman who apparently was trying to impress you and brought out some artifacts from his ancestors, Ku Klux Klan stuff.
Yeah, he it was funny because he, like, sent flowers to the restaurant. And, you know, I was up at the desk and they're like, oh, we have a delivery for Liz. And so, like, I'm carrying it back and I'm telling my friend, I'm like, Misty, there's some flowers for Liz. And she looks at me and started, you know, busts out laughing. She's like, that's for you. I'm like, who's sending me flowers? You know, and then it was this guy and he came by later that night, and you know, was, you know, I think his attempt at flirting, I don't know if anyone would call it successful. And he pulled out this, you know, KKK Grand Wizard outfit, you know, to try to show me, and his, like, great uncle was a Grand Wizard, and he was proud of it. And I was horrified. I left. And you know, then, like, I spent a year and a half up at the restaurant, like, on and off. And they eventually, like, the people that worked with me got to know who I was and my background and all that. And, you know, didn't seem to have any problem with it once they got to know me.
And then at some point, you decided to move to the Atlanta area. Why Atlanta?
Well, Atlanta was the closest city to Highlands. Highlands was too small of a town. I couldn't do it, and there wasn't much to do. It was like a resort town, so you either worked in hotel and restaurant industry or, you know, you lived there. And it was a predominantly older community, and so Atlanta was the closest city, and it was warm. I grew up in the desert, so I didn't want to move back north. And so I moved a few days before my 24th birthday.
And I was thinking when I'd read that you made that decision, makes a little more sense now that you explained it. You were in North Carolina first.
Yeah.
But I wondered, you know, moving to the South, you know, as a Muslim immigrant, you know, Jordanian immigrant. But I don't know whether you factored that all in. And by this time, you'd already been in North Carolina, so.
Well, yeah, I'd been in North Carolina, and that's where I fell in love with the South. Like, you know, I mean, there were some, you know, incidences that, you know, stand out, like, you know, the guy with the KKK outfit. And but there's also this incredible hospitality that the people I worked with showed me that no other group had showed me before. Mm-hmm. You know, and we have some similarities in our food, like the okra and the rice and the beans and all that stuff and the sweet tea. But there's a hospitality that I experienced with Southerners that I haven't experienced in any other part of the country.
So there were some positives. I'm probably selling the South short in that terms. And I believe you worked as a waitress and probably various other jobs. At a certain point, you started a business.
I did. I worked as a waitress, you know, freelance doing graphic and web design and some temping, just was trying to piece it together, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. You know, and then I opened up a cafe in Decatur, Georgia.
Decatur, tell me what kind of a town Decatur was.
So Decatur's it's like right out of Atlanta. I don't know if you're familiar with Atlanta, but Atlanta's just sprawl. So you have Atlanta and then all these like little suburbs that attach to it. It's about 10-15 minutes from downtown Atlanta. It's predominantly white, middle class to upper middle class, educated. There's Agnes Scott College is right there. Emory University is about 15 minutes away. It's a great little town. It's got everything you would need there.
And I suppose, you know, who knows the way your life would have gone, but as I understand it, you like to take some drives, and a rather fateful day, you took a drive and noticed some boys playing soccer in the, I guess, the nearby field or in the street, and decide you wanted to join them.
Well, the one thing Decatur didn't have was a Middle Eastern grocery store, and so I would venture out to Clarkston, which was 5 minutes away from Decatur, to this Middle Eastern grocery store, and I'd literally just go to the store and back, never anywhere else around the area, and, you know, never questioned why there was a Middle Eastern grocery store in this town. And then one day, like on my way back from the store, I missed my turn and had to U-turn into this apartment complex. And when I did, I saw these boys in the parking lot of their complex playing barefoot with this really raggedy ball. And they had, you know, two stones set up as their goals. And, you know, and then that image, like, stuck with me. It was the way I grew up playing soccer. And maybe I was a little homesick or something, but, you know, I stayed in my car and watched them for an hour or so, and then headed home. But I came back out later in the week, and this time I was a little bit more prepared. I was armed with a soccer ball, and I stepped out of my car, and the boys rushed the car right away, and they wanted the ball, and so I asked to play in exchange for that. And they got in their little huddle, and debated amongst themselves whether they would let the strange woman play with them, but eventually the fact that I had a much nicer ball, it won out, and they let me on a team very reluctantly and gave me the chubby kid and the tiny one, but it was great. It was and I played with them for a few hours and continued to come out and play with them.
Did you know, and I assume among these kids, you know, the refugees?
I did. I mean, they stood out as not being from this country. I think when you're not from this country, it's easy for you to identify those that aren't. Just little, sometimes it's mannerisms, sometimes it's accents. With these boys, it was very obvious they weren't. The first group of kids I met were from Afghanistan and Sudan, and so they spoke broken English, and yeah. So I did know they were refugees.
So how did it happen from this encounter in a pickup game to starting some teams, coaching some teams?
It happened very organically. Like, we would play together, you know, quite often, and they would ask questions like, how do you know how to play and all this stuff? And I told them that I was a coach. I'd coached previously at a local YMCA and had a girls' team that I'd coached for 4 years and was getting jaded by the experience. Youth soccer can sometimes get a little bit overly competitive, and the team that I had coached had changed from, you know, like a fun experience to something to win at all costs mentality with some of the parents. So I was looking for another outlet to go back to the game that I love. And so when they found out that I coached, they said, oh, you know, can we have our own team? I was like, you guys want us to have our own team? And they got excited at that. I think a few of them thought we were going to have our own professional soccer team. But we ended up forming our own team. We started flyering the neighborhood, and then the boys and I would drive around in my car, and we'd approach kids in the neighborhood that were about the right size and tell them about the tryouts. And yeah, it was from there we started the first team, and now it's grown to four teams.
And even more in this foundation that we'll get to a little bit later. Some great work going on. We're talking with Luma Mufle, who is coach. She's coach Luma. She's known to her players. Started some soccer teams in the small town of Clarkston, Georgia. It's a suburb of Atlanta. High population of refugees there. Started some soccer teams for refugee boys. They're called the Fugees, and that's grown and grown until now there's a foundation and a lot of help for the boys and their families. And we'll get into how Luma Mufle got into all of that, been profiling a little bit of her personal story. This book, based on this story, it's called Outcast United, An American Town, A Refugee Team, and One Woman's Quest to Make a Difference by New York Times reporter Warren St. John. Here's a quote from the biography of Luma Mufle from the Speakers Bureau. She says, I thought I would coach twice a week and on weekends, like coaching other kids. Instead, it's a 40 or 50 hours a week, coaching, finding jobs, taking people to the hospital. You start off on your own, and you suddenly have a family of 120. I guess that explains, kind of in capsule form, what happened from just coaching this team.
Well, like, I would coach the kids, and then after practice, a couple of the kids would approach me to help them with their homework. Their parents were illiterate, couldn't read or write English, and so I was the one person that they knew that could help them, and so, you know, of course I did. And so I would, you know, started out first helping like a couple of kids at their house, and then the other kids heard about it, and then they wanted help with their homework. And, you know, then I would just hop from apartment to apartment, or sometimes there would be like seven or eight of us in the hallway of one of the apartment complexes trying to get work done. And I was like, wow, this is not very efficient way of doing it. And, you know, so I tried to round up some friends and volunteers to get more people involved to do that. But it was like, you know, they were refugees in this country, and we were supposed to give them this, like, welcome to America. But for the most part, they get left on their own. And so when they find someone in their community that is willing to do a little bit, a lot of them will latch on. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're getting calls, you know, to go to the hospital or help them fill out their food stamps application. And I don't know, like, for me, like, I was working with the kids, and so how am I going to say no to the mom that I can't help with her food stamp applications? Because if I didn't, then it wouldn't get filled out, and then the kids that I coach wouldn't have food.
There's a particular story, and this is on the website, FugeesFamily.org, which is the website of the foundation. I wonder if you could tell this. It's an experience of one of the kids on your team. I think you're giving him a ride home. And he says, I'm hungry. Mm-hmm. And then you found out he really was hungry.
Yeah, so I was seeing one of the kids home, and he's, like, holding his stomach, and I'm like, what's wrong? And he's like, Coach, I'm hungry. I was like, don't worry, we're going to be at your house in a couple of minutes. You'll have something to eat there. You know, I was thinking he was trying to get me to, you know, stop at McDonald's or Taco Bell or something for him. And he's like, no, Coach, we don't have any food at home. And I'm like, yeah, of course you have food at home. There's got to be something there. He's like, no, it's that time of the month. And I'm like, what do you mean it's that time of the month? And I found out that time of the month meant the time the food stamps run out. And I'd gone into the apartment complex and gone into his apartment. And when I walked in, the apartment was completely dark, and his mom was in the corner rocking back and forth saying, I work hard every day I work. And there was nothing in the fridge. There was nothing in the cupboards. And there's this woman who was working 40 hours a week at, you know, a four or five star hotel in town, working full time, but commuting 2 hours each way to get there because of our public transportation system. She had three boys under the age of 14 and wasn't making ends meet. And so I went to, the boy and I went to the grocery store. We picked a bunch of groceries, and I came back and I sat with the mom and I tried to make a budget. And here I was thinking, oh, I'm college educated. This woman's probably spending beyond her means. And we sat down and I couldn't make ends meet. Like, there was nothing that she was spending money on that was not a necessity, that wasn't a bill she had to pay, and that she didn't have any credit card bills. And that was a really rude awakening for me, to think that, you know, the kids that living 5 miles away from me, kids that I've been working with, were going to bed hungry because they weren't getting paid enough to make ends meet. Because I always believed if you worked hard enough, you could make it. So, like, all these, like, small little stories and experiences I had, like, really shook a lot of my beliefs and opened me up to the reality of what it's like to live in this country if you're low income or you don't speak the language or you don't have any skills.
And this, on top of experiences like this, I'm sure we're not unique, on top of horrible things that the parents and the children would have experienced in many cases to make them, you know, refugees.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, Clarkston, Georgia was chosen as a refugee center, one of many around the country, because of, I don't know, services and et cetera available. But apparently you found out that many times these just were overwhelmed or were not sufficient, obviously.
I don't think they're sufficient, and I don't think there's enough of them. You know, I think they're put into these different resettlement locations around the country, you know, because, oh, there's affordable housing or they have access to jobs. But that's not enough. Like, you know, in order for someone to be successful, you have to give them some skills so they can get out of this cycle. And, you know, Clarkston wasn't prepared for any of this. I don't think any town that had an influx of refugees was prepared. I mean, there's been incidences in, like, Lewiston, Maine, and Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Des Moines, Iowa, which are all also resettlement locations, that have had similar experiences to Clarkston. So I don't think Clarkston is unique in its resistance to having refugees resettle here or in its not being able to handle all of it.
So we'll take a brief break, and then when we come back with Luma Mufle, I'll ask her to introduce us to especially some of the original players on that first team, and some of their stories, beginning with some of the horrible things they went through, and then some of the hope that programs like the soccer program Luma Mufle has provided them, give them, and some of the hopes I'm sure she has for some of these young men, including college and successful lives in the United States. Luma Mufle is the subject of the book Outcasts United, An American Town, A Refugee Team, and One Woman's Quest to Make a Difference by New York Times reporter Warren St. John. Tale of Clarkston, Georgia, a refugee settlement center, changes brought to that town by an influx of refugees, and what Luma Mufle, an American-educated Jordanian woman, tried to do and is continuing to try to do to help, especially the young men of the town and their families through soccer and other programs. We'll continue with Luma Mufle after this brief break.
This is Contemporary Western Women. I'm Elaine Thatcher. Julie Jensen is a playwright living in Salt Lake City. Her plays have been produced all over the United States and in London. For many years, she taught college classes in playwriting. But she didn't always expect to be writing plays.
I was an actress, and I was auditioning for Shakespeare Festival in Santa Cruz. And, you know, it was hard. I mean, being an actress, God, it's so hard. So I said to myself, okay, if I don't get in this festival, I'm going to quit this. It's stupid. I don't like it. I hate the auditions. And I'm not doing this anymore. And so, of course, I auditioned and I didn't get in. And then the great relief when I realized, oh, then I'm going to write plays, aren't I? And the answer was, of course, yes. And then I realized that nobody's standing in your way saying, no, you can't do that now. You didn't get in. If you wanted to write your play, you could write the play. They didn't have to do it, but you could write it. So they weren't stopping you from practicing your craft. And that seemed to me a gift, which it is.
Julie grew up in Beaver, Utah, and many of her plays reflect the cultural milieu of rural Utah. Her play, Two-Headed, is about the Mountain Meadows Massacre that took place on September 11, 1857. The massacre was a forbidden topic in her family, largely because she had an ancestor who was involved in the crime.
The metaphor was, okay, I mean, I put the two-headed calf in there later because I named it because I didn't care if you actually got this or not, but how it feels to be hauling around a secret. How it feels to be two things, to know something and not know things, to know something and not talk about them. So that's what it meant. And I think we all have experience being two-headed. It's just about what. Mm-hmm. And so that was the reason it was named that. I had always been interested. My family was a part of it, so it was one of those things you didn't speak of, and we talked about it. And you couldn't get Juanita Brooks's book, and my father had a copy of it, and he kind of shuttled it around the family, and they would kind of sit in the back room and talk about it. So it had this aura about it. The massacre always did have this weird aura.
In the play Two-Headed, the characters possess items that you later learn came from the massacred immigrants.
I was talking to my sister one day, and I said, you know what the access to that story is the stuff. It's the stuff that they got, you know, that they would have things. They would have weird stuff. And that would be the way into the story. And then as soon as I thought that up, I was done. Because I could imagine, oh, of course, kids. And then what happens, kids who saw it or heard about it or voodoo, like me. It had an ominous feel about it. And then as soon as I knew that my access was those camisoles, in that case, it came easily after that.
Contemporary Western Women is a project of Utah State University's Center for Women and Gender and Utah Public Radio. We focus on women in the Rocky Mountain region and their stories of strength, hope, and humor in all aspects of life. If you have a story to share or know someone who does, please visit the Contemporary Western Women link at upr.org or call 1-800-826-1495. I'm Elaine Thatcher.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
The following program originally aired in August 2010.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Thanks for tuning in. If you just tuned in, we're talking to Luma Mufle, who is coach. She's known as Coach Luma to her athletes who are refugee boys. It's a town in Georgia, small town, a suburb of Atlanta called Clarkston, designated as a refugee center. And from 90% white in 1980 to now, one in every three is is from out of the country, and 50 countries represented in this small town, Georgia. It's undergone a radical transformation the last few years. And a lot of refugee boys suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, having seen horrible things, their families as well, of course, found a common bond in soccer. And Luma Bufle started some soccer teams called the Fugees, short for refugees, composed of refugee boys. It's the story of this woman who became involved in the lives of her young charges, keeping the boys in school and out of gangs and helping the families survive as well. The book is Outcast United, An American Town, A Refugee Team, and One Woman's Quest to Make a Difference by New York Times reporter Warren St. John. And she's our guest for the hour on the program. I neglected to talk about 9/11. Of course, in the middle of all this, and you're living in the South, and not to say it's any different from anywhere else in the United States, that would have maybe had an impact in the life of a woman from Jordan, a Muslim. Did you have any experiences following 9/11 in that vein?
I think a lot of it was the talk, and the, you know, whether it was on TV or the radios or even amongst acquaintances, you know, the Islamophobia that was coming out. It was hard to hear that, because in no way did, you know, what happened on 9/11 would have been justified by any Muslim. So it was hard hearing a religion that I believe in come under attack. And I remember there was one time I was at this gas station. I was getting ready to pay for my car, the gas, and the woman in front of me was veiled, and the guy asked her to leave. And this was an Indian guy, you know, like telling her, no, we're not going to serve you here. And no one in the gas station spoke up. No one said anything, including myself. Like, I didn't know how to stand up. I was scared to identify as that. And so, yeah.
What about your players? I don't know if by then, you know, you were coaching, but maybe, you know, a few years later, any problems in the post-9/11 atmosphere?
I think we still live in a post-9/11 world. I mean, even now, like with a potential Islamic center near Ground Zero, I mean, you're hearing a lot of the rhetoric that we heard around 9/11. You know, and there are times, like, we would go to games, like, in the past 2 or 3 years, and, you know, they have to read the names of the players out loud to verify that they're the ones who are playing. And, you know, we have a couple of Muhammads on our team, and, you know, a couple of Abdullahs, and, you know, every now and then you'd hear a comment, oh, what kind of names are these? Or the ref would snicker or mock it, and it's hard.
Do you get questions from any of the boys on your team about any of these issues?
No, I think sometimes they don't understand what's going on. And, you know, like, I mean, they'll sometimes, like, we'll get stared at when we walk onto a field. Like, we call a lot of attention. You have this team. It's all refugee boys, predominantly boys from Africa, playing in a predominantly white sport at this point, and led by a female coach. And so we get people looking at us, and, you know, like, I remember walking onto one field, and the one of the kids, like, he just grabs my arm. He's like, coach, it's all white people. And I'm looking at him, I'm like, it's always white people when we play. You know, like, it's not any different. You know, and after the game, we'd had, like, a couple of slurs during the game at the kids, you know, tell them to go back to, you know, where they came from, or go back to Africa. And, you know, one of the kids, like, why do they say stuff like that? I was like, I don't know. And he's like, what if they knew about you? What would they say then? You know, mm-hmm. I was like, what do you mean, what if they knew about me? He's like, what if they knew you were Muslim? Mm-hmm. You know, and we jokingly sometimes, you know, like, I'll tell the kids, I was like, maybe I should wear a burqa to the field to see what kind of reactions we would get. Mm-hmm. And they begged me not to do that, mm-hmm. not that I think I ever would.
Mm-hmm. Plus, there are economic disparities, right? That a lot of teams that you played would have been, you know, the spending thousands of dollars on the kids, on the equipment, on everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we had one game, we showed up, and you know, my first team had just finished, and my second team is coming in, and we're trading our cleats. You know, we're sharing cleats among the team, and, you know, trading our shin guards. And the other team is examining the field, trying to decide what screw-in cleat they need to put in. Like, is it soft enough, or do we need to put a harder turf screw-in? And we're looking at them like they're crazy. But it was refreshing to know that, hey, we didn't need all that equipment to have a good game.
No. I wonder if you could tell me about some of the boys, especially on that the first team, maybe you know, one or two that especially stands out to you. Maybe tell their story.
I've coached a lot of boys over 200 in the past 6 years, so all of them have some pretty powerful and traumatic backgrounds. But the most important thing, I think, in their stories is their resilience and them being able to overcome what they've been through. I've had a kid from Afghanistan. I got really close to his family and got to know their backstory quite well. And he had grown up in northern Afghanistan, the Taliban had raided their village a few times and ended up taking the father and the older brother away. And at that point, the mom was like, okay, we're leaving. And so she packed up her three boys and daughter, and they made their journey to Pakistan by foot and by truck. And at one point, they were smuggled over the border in this truck that was transporting rugs, and they were hiding under these rugs. And the boy talks of when, you know, it was the truck was stopped, and they were trying to... the Taliban was searching, but the rugs were too heavy for them to lift up, so they didn't bother. But at the same point, the boys were having a hard time breathing with all this weight over them. Mm-hmm. And they were 7 or 8 when they did that escape. And they ended up going to Pakistan and having to work. They actually, it's ironic, they had to ended up working in a carpet or rug manufacturing company. And at 7 or 8 years old, were hand weaving these Pakistani rugs. So their family could make ends meet. And to this day, they have not heard from their father or brother. I think the younger boy holds on to the hope that they're alive because he speaks of them as they are. But the mom, I think, has accepted that they're not. So.
And this would be a common thread running through a lot of the stories of the boys you coached.
Yeah, I mean, the common thread is that they were forced to flee their country. Some of them, you know, like we've had one kid seen his father shot in front of him. A couple of the kids have seen their mothers raped in front of them. Like, there's always this, like, horrible atrocity to force them to leave. And they've seen that. Like, these are kids that are, you know, 8, 10, 15 that are seeing this. And that's part of their childhood. No child should ever have to experience something like that.
And then they flee their home country and come to a very different environment. And it, I guess, in many, many times that look down upon, you know, racial epithets not accepted. Mm-hmm. And so the problems continue.
Yeah, like, you know, they've left their countries. They've fled. You know, they've had to live in refugee camps, you know, like having to get their own well water and scrape for food and not go to school. And then, you know, they're one of the lucky few that we say, oh, you guys get to come to America and start anew. And then they come here and they're not treated with any respect. And they don't understand it because they've done nothing wrong. Like, I always tell them, like, you know, people will respect you if you respect them. But then some days, you know, we'll have interactions where someone is very disrespectful to them. And so, like, teaching them to rise above that and walk away from it, because they are remarkable young men.
Hmm. What do, you know, if we're looking to help or to reach out to any refugees that might be in our communities, what do refugees most need?
I think it depends on when they're coming in. Like, those that come in immediately need help trying to figure out the system, whether it's filling out food stamp applications, registering for school, getting school supplies, you know, furniture for their apartments. I'm sure if there's any organizations that do resettlement, furniture is a big thing, that because they have to outfit these apartments for the families. And then I think it's also doing long-term programming, because, like, you can't just bring people in, give them 3 or 4 months of help, and then expect them to have successful, full lives. So that's where we step in.
Now, when you started these teams, I don't know, I'm guessing you probably didn't envision where this has ended up with Fuji's family and the foundation and a lot of programs. What was your goal originally?
I didn't have a goal. I think it was more selfish, like it was for me. I wanted to coach a group of kids. I wanted to get back into the game that I love, and it just grabbed me. It was life-changing, you know, and I was 29, 30 at the time when this happened, and I didn't expect my life to get so immersed in theirs and this be my life's work. But I don't regret for a single moment like what happened and how it came about.
We're talking on Access Utah today with Luma Mufle, who is a Jordanian woman, educated in America, went to college in America, went to American British schools in Jordan, decided in college to stay in America and make her life here. And little did she know that that would include not only coaching refugee boys in soccer, but helping them and helping their families and making, as she just said, making this her life's work. But that has happened. And this part of the story is told in the book Outcast United, An American Town, A Refugee Team, and One Woman's Quest to Make a Difference. New York Times reporter Warren St. John is the author. You said in a New York, National Public Radio interview, this was interesting to me, the practice and the games that you're referring to, it's the only part of their day where they're not criticized, where they're not made fun of, where they don't feel like they don't belong, and they need that hour and a half every day.
Yeah, like I have a lot of people that will approach me and say, oh, we need to have therapy for your kids. We need to, you know, have them talk with some professionals. And maybe, you know, they're right, but at the same point, like, our kids need to feel like they're normal. And they need to feel like they belong. And no place else does that happen except on the soccer field. At school, they get teased for their accents. They stand out. But on the field, with the Fugees, like, your difference is normal. Like, if you're from a different country, if you speak funny, if you eat different food, that's what we are. And so they need that. Like, we all need a part of our day. Like, it's sad that they only get an hour and a half, or now it's three because they have to go to tutoring, where it's normal, where they're okay, where everything they do is good. And the thing is, a lot of them are very gifted athletes, so they excel. So they're like the stars for that hour and a half.
Yeah, I think for any young person, it's very fulfilling to find something you're good at and to do that and to feel that satisfaction. Even more important for boys who've gone through what they've gone through, horrible things, to get on the soccer pitch and this is something they're very good at.
Yeah. I mean, they could be doing something else with that time. You know, they could be joining gangs. They could be, shoplifting or, you know, but they don't do that. They want to do something that's a bit more positive.
And I guess these are some of the pitfalls for young men in a refugee community, gangs, drugs, you know, other problems?
Those are the big ones, gangs and drugs. We've had two shootings in the past 3 weeks at one of the apartment complexes where the bulk of my kids live. They were coming home from practice one day, and there's this Burmese man, a 21-year-old, that was shot by a rival African-American gang. In a drive-by, and our kids were there when it happened. Like, they heard the shot, and then one of the boys ended up having to call 911 to get the police out there. So the reality in Clarkston is it's pretty rough. You know, it's not like the small, sleepy southern town. It's a little bit rougher than that.
So part of what you're doing with your rules, you have some very strict rules, is trying to get the young men to live up to certain standards and keep them protected from some of this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that if you set standards high enough for any group of kids, those kids will live up to that. And if you set the standards low, that's where they'll go. So we set the standards very high. Like, for our kids, you're expected to graduate from high school and you're expected to go to college. You know, it's not like, oh, the lucky one will get to go. Or only a few of you will get to go. No, if you work hard enough, you're going to go. And keep them off the streets and expose them to different opportunities that they can have and what else is out there and what else is possible for them.
And that's your hope for all your boys? They go to college and from there, successful lives?
You know, I think for most of them, that is the hope. But, you know, every now and then we'll get boys that are 17, 18. And, like, we got a kid last week. He's been here 3 weeks. He's 18. You know, I don't know how we can prepare him for college. So with that, we have a different approach. We try to get him into a GED course, get him paired up to learn a trade or a skill, and then go with that. I think my hope is for them to have a different life than what their parents are having right now, is that they'll have opportunities, that they don't have to work at the chicken factory or clean hotel rooms, that they can, you know, drive a truck or manage a McDonald's or be a doctor or be a lawyer. It's whatever they want to be. But I don't believe in cutting them off and saying, no, you can't do any of that stuff.
Do you have success stories that, you know, from the kids from early on with the soccer teams and some of these programs that have now made a success that you can point to?
Yeah, I mean, we've had 10 boys graduate from high school or get their high school diploma. 9 of them are in college right now on academic or athletic scholarships, and the first one will graduate next year. And that kind of hit me hard. Like, I was talking to him the other day. He's like, Coach, can you please not enter the President's Cup this year? I'm like, no, we enter it every year. This is a big tournament in Georgia. And I'm like, why wouldn't I enter? He's like, I'm graduating. And I'm like, no, you graduate next year. And he's like, no, I'm graduating in May. And I couldn't believe it, because I coached him, you know, when he was 15, 16, and now he's graduating from college. And that was pretty cool to hear that.
Yeah, that must be very gratifying.
Yeah.
And to know that there'll be other success stories down the road.
Yeah, well, and it's not just one. It's like there's, you know, every year from now on, we're going to have somewhat one or two or three kids graduating from college and from high school. And for all our kids, they're going to be the first in their families to graduate from high school, and let alone go to college.
Tell me a little bit about some of the programs with the Fugees Family Foundation. By the way, the website is fugeesfamily.org. One of the problems, as I understand it, is problems reading. So you've and other academic problems. I noticed you've set up a Fugees Academic Boot Camp.
Yeah, we a lot of the kids, when they come to this country, they're put in the age-appropriate class. So if you're 13, 14, you're put into 8th or 9th grade, having had no formal schooling in your life. So you're expected to take 8th and 9th grade math, even if you can't add or multiply. You're expected to read the literature of that class, even though you can't read. And our kids get passed through the system because they're a burden. And so I've had experiences with kids that have been in the public school system 3 or 4 years, and they can't read, but they're getting A's and B's. So a couple of academic programs we started. The first one we did was we started an academic boot camp during the summer, where the boys attend academic camp for 6 weeks. They attend at Agnes Scott. We bike in 7 miles every day, and we have all these teachers and professors teaching the boys different reading and academic skills. And then the afternoons we do health curriculum or math or science or group projects, and then we head back. And so for 6 weeks from 8 to 4:30, they're doing that instead of laying around at home doing nothing. And then we started our own private middle school, 6th through 8th grade academy right now for 22 boys. And we have those boys from 8 to 3:30, so it functions like a regular school. We have teachers, and then they participate in our after-school programming.
Any plans for the future, hopes that you haven't achieved right now but would hope to in the future?
Well, we in December, we accomplished, I think, our first hope or dream. We purchased 19 acres of land in Clarkston where we plan to build our home field and our school. And it will be the first school for refugee kids in the country that's dedicated to refugee education. And it will be a 6th through 12th grade private academy. Right now it's boys only, but when we build our facility, we'll be bringing in our first group of girls.
Mm. Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
On a personal note, and this is in the epilogue to the book Outcasts United, and hopefully everyone's read the book. I'm not ruining anything. a very happy note in the personal story of Luma Mufle. There's been a reconciliation with your parents, right?
Yes. You know, it happened right as I was starting my work with the Fugees. But I remember a few years ago, I was talking to my dad, and he was frustrated with my brother, who is not taking any job right now because he wanted, you know, higher pay or whatever. And my dad's like, I don't understand. Like, how can I get him to be more like you, like to work harder? And I was like, oh, just cut him off. And he looked at me. He's like, I'll never make that mistake again. And that was the first time, like, he acknowledged that. But we've had, you know, I think a lot of parental relationships go through ups and downs, and ours is a little bit more public. but my dad has a Google alert on me, so he'll like call and say, "Oh, you're speaking at Utah State on Saturday," and I'm like, "Dad, I know, like I agreed to do it." He's like, "No, Google just sent me the notification," and I've had to explain that Google doesn't know stuff before I do.
Very good. Very good.
But yeah.
And there's a very nice scene in the book near the end of the book where your parents are over for a visit and your dad's cooking food for everyone on the team.
Yeah, he's actually coming in October and the boys are all excited because he doesn't consider a meal without meat, and they love that. So, and he doesn't know how to cook for two or three people, so they'll come over quite regularly when he's there.
And in the book, a presence is your grandmother, who has been an influence on you. It seems like a very wise woman. She predicted that give your parents time and they would reconcile with you, I guess.
I think most of our grandparents are a lot wiser than our parents. But
yeah. Well, we've reached the end of the time. Lima Mufle is the subject of the book, Outcast United, an American town, a refugee team, and one woman's quest to make a difference. Lima Mufle has made that difference, continues to do so with the refugee community in Georgia. And her teams are called the Fugees. And the foundation now is the Fugees Family Foundation, which is providing a lot of services for a refugee community. Fugeesfamily.org is the website. Lima Mufle, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you so much, and thanks for listening to Access Utah.
CD copies of Access Utah are available. Call us at 1-800-826-1495 or go online to upr.org. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSU-FM and KUSU-FM HD1 91.5 Logan, and KUSR and KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan.